Hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book In Broken Water by Adelard Coles. We're on chapter 4, and this is the third part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 4, The Frisian Islands. The wind remained west, so on the following morning we got away at 8 a.m. and quickly sped down the channel which we had explored at low tide the previous night. The Dutch channels are marked on one side only by small trees that have all the lower limbs lopped off, or possibly these are of a variety that has no lower branches. When corners in the channel arrive, the last beacon on one side has its top branches tied together to show that the tree will in future be on the other side of the channel. Having once found this, we easily managed the navigation of these muddy waters, the Lauwerszee, as they are called. A long island appeared before us, low on the horizon. It was highest on the west, where there was a tower and two beacons, and it gradually tapered away to sea level at the east. It was the Schiermonnikoog, a low upheaval of sand dunes some 5 miles long, that was really much nearer than it appeared, as the visibility was poor. We were now in the deep main channel of Vreeschseegat. This was well buoyed on each side. The weather was fine, and it was very nearly high tide. Just the time, in fact, for navigation behind the island, so we decided to take a shortcut across the sands. We jibed and ran along a fairly well-marked channel, leaving a row of withies on our port hand. It was not any easy to see these at high tide, since only a little shrub remained above water. Having come to the end of the withies, it was time to set a compass course and feel our way with the lead across the sands. This we managed satisfactorily by constantly taking soundings, finding depths of water never less than 5 feet under us, but when safely across the banks, we found it difficult to find the entrance to the sea. Schiermonnikoog dwindles to nothing towards the east, so our only course was to follow close to the southern shore until we found a gap, using the lead all the time. This we did until, having run aground twice, we got into a deep channel that appeared to lead to the open sea. By that time, the wind had fallen almost to a calm, and the white sands, dazzling in the sun, looked very tempting. Down went the anchor, and in a short time the dinghy was ready for us alongside. In the course of the day, we had seen many whiskered faces suddenly appearing in the sea and staring at us in true Dutch style. We decided they were seals, so a revolver was not forgotten when fitting out the dinghy, as we hoped to shoot at one. Author's note, 1956. How strange! Recently, as a reviewer, I criticised a yachtsman for shooting at seals and porpoises, yet now I read that 30 years ago, I too was prepared to do the same thing. A few hard pulls at the sculls, and we were ashore. Having pulled the dinghy a short way up to the firm sand, we set about exploring. Schiermonnikoog is inhabited only at its western end, and to the east it is just a waste of sand dunes and sandy shores strewn with wreckage thrown up by the sea. The only inhabitants are the seabirds, who have it all to themselves except for occasional intrusions by fishermen or those in search of flotsam and jetsam. Just across the channel lay Simon's Sand, which really is uninhabited. We found a sense of satisfaction in thus coming to strange places simply by chart and compass. As we walked along the shore, we came close to an upturned barrel, behind which I thought I saw something move. I was not mistaken, and as I ran forward it moved again. We had found a young seal, a priceless little fellow with beady eyes and long whiskers. We were more afraid of him than he of us, and it took some minutes before Dunsterville took courage and picked him up. He was very tame, and made no attempt to bite. We carried it to a pool and made it swim. At first it sank and had to swim a yard or two before it got up sufficient speed to come to the surface. It seemed hungry and sucked at our legs. The afternoon crept by whilst we bathed, lay in the sun or played with the seal in a very juvenile way. We remained in our anchorage under the lee of the land all night. The weather was calm, and although in a fit of energy we got underway at 8 o'clock in the morning, we soon gave up the attempt of beating out against the tide and a light headwind. It was a lovely, warm, sunny morning, so we went ashore to see how our baby seal was getting on. It was still in its old place by the barrel, but seemed nearly dead with the sun beating down on it. We carried it to the sea, where it quickly revived, and as it looked hungry, we tried to feed it with condensed milk, and afterwards with sardines. It would not swallow anything, however, and spat the milk out all over my legs. At midday, the wind freshened, and we again made sail. We had taken the seal aboard a net, but it was rather large for a pet, so, having got underway, we threw it overboard. To our surprise, instead of making for the shore, the seal swam frantically after us, whining and making the most extraordinary noises. It kept pace with the yacht for some way, but eventually it fell behind and turned back towards Khermonnikoog, where I hope it was found by its mama. When the yacht arrived off the eastern spit of Khermonnikoog, we had to find a channel leading between the islands and sandbanks further east, and between shoals to the open North Sea. The positions of the sands are always shifting, especially after gales, and the channel is narrow and unbuoyed. Charts, particularly small-scale ones, are, of course, useless for this kind of navigation, and one relies entirely on taking soundings and on the look of the water. It was a place where no mistake could be made, as if the wind freshened, it would bring in a swell which would quickly knock the boat to pieces if she grounded in such an exposed position. We could see where the channel lay approximately, and as it was a headwind, we lay on each tack until we sounded 5 feet. In practice, not as easy as it sounds, for the channel was winding and the strong tide was not constant in direction, being deflected by shoals. Moreover, Khermonnikoog was so extraordinarily low that when a quarter mile away it was out of sight, as the visibility was again so poor. Happily, the lead began continually to record a fathom, neither more nor less, so we knew we were on the bar. Curiously enough, the water did not materially deepen for a considerable time, and Annette was very well out to sea before we sounded 5 fathoms. Experiments in navigation of this sort, needless to say, could only be risked with a flood tide in very settled weather. The Frisian Islands, off which we were sailing, are like a string of long, narrow beads lying about 3 miles off the Dutch and German mainland. Between them are deep channels, like the one we had just sailed through, but much encumbered with shoals. Behind most of the islands there were channels, roughly parallel to the shore, deep at each end but drying out at low water in the centre. Between the islands and the mainland, the whole area dries out except for the channels and gullies, exposing miles of sand and mud, where there are reputed to be quicksands. Khermonnikoog, which we had just left, is most easterly of the Dutch islands, with the exception of a few sandbanks like Simon Sand and the small round island of Rottum, which is a little more than a big sandbank. East of Rottum is Borkum, the first of the German islands, followed by Joist, Noordenee, Baltrum, Langerug, Spekerug, and Wangerug. The Dutch and German islands are identical in formation, just sand dunes facing the North Sea, but separated by channels, some of which are deep and important. One arm of the estuary of the River Ems joins the sea between Rottum and Borkum, and the other between Borkum and Joist. East of Wangerug lies the estuaries of the Jade, the Weser, and the Elbe. These deep channels, leading respectively to Wilhelmshaven, Bremerhaven and Hamburg, are used by big ships and are well buoyed, but the others are not so well marked, and some have no buoys at all. The shallow channels leading transversely across the sands between the islands and the mainland are marked rather indifferently by withies, which are often out of position. There are also wide fringes of sand and shoal water extending far to seaward on the northern sides of the islands. The whole area is interesting from the navigational point of view, and with the exception of the deep fairways, is most devoid of ships. While cruising there, we saw only one other yacht, and only occasionally a fishing boat. It was 1:30 p.m. by the time we reached deep water off Khermonnikoog, and we stood out to sea another 2.5 miles before coming round on the port tack and setting a course to the eastward. During the afternoon, we passed Rottum and Borkum, and then picked up the outer buoys of the eastern Ems. It was getting late by then, so we freed our sheets and followed the well-buoyed deep channel between Borkum and Joist until we passed Mehmet, where we altered course and followed another channel leading eastward behind Joist until it became so dark that we could not see the buoys and had to let go the anchor. Mehmet is the island on which the plot of The Riddle of the Sands was centred. It is just a flat pancake of sand dunes, and against the evening sun we could not see a sign of habitation. Our anchorage was a lonely one. To the northwest was Mehmet, 3 miles away. To the north was Joist and the mainland, which here receded to the south, and that was about 8 miles distant. At low water, we were sheltered by the sandbanks, which dried out on either side of the channel, but when these were covered, the yacht was in an exposed position. Davies, in The Riddle of the Sands, describes these Frisian anchorages as being sheltered by the banks, which he said act like underwater breakwaters. But at high tide, we found they offer little protection, since although they may break the swell, a considerable short sea can be raised when it has a fetch of several miles, even over shallow water. However, it was fine settled weather, and we turned in happy and content with our day's sailing. We carried on next day behind Joist with little wind but a hot tide. The channel, which is narrow and shallows progressively, soon became very involved. It is marked by withies on the north side, but we found these were sometimes difficult to spot and not always in the right position. Twice we ran aground, so it was not until 2 p.m. that we covered the 8 miles and dropped anchor off the southwest corner of Nordnay under the lee of the land. Just before we brought up and after we had all changed into shore-going clothes, Dunsterville hauled on the reefing line of our roller foresail and somehow fell overboard. He clung to the line desperately while the speed of the yacht dragged him underwater. I immediately luffed and he was soon safely aboard, but alas, his glad rags looked most woebegone. Provisions were very short, so I shoved a few 100,000 marks into my pocket and we jumped into the dinghy and rowed ashore. We landed on the open beach and left the dinghy with a crowd of well-behaved Boche boys and proceeded to survey the town. Nordenay is the principal German bathing resort on the North Sea. Like most of the Frisian islands, it is itself a long island, high to the west and trailing away to nothing at the east. The western shore is crowded with hotels, pensions and shops, and when we arrived, the streets were thronged with gay holidaymakers as the season had just begun. Germany then seemed anything but a poor country, but we were soon to learn it was only a small proportion of rich people who were able to spend their summer at a bathing resort. We were very surprised to find, so soon after the war, that the people were friendly, and as we had made pretty good progress, we debated whether to stay a day or two at Nordenay. I felt we ought to carry on as long as it was possible to sail, and later experience has shown me that this is the only way to cruise with any chance of success. Always to make a passage when possible, and to waste time ashore only when the weather is very bad or unsettled. Buster, however, pointed out that it was supposed to be a pleasure cruise, and I only too willingly assented. Chapter 5. The Theft of the Yacht. Next day was another real summer one, hot and windless with the sun blazing on the blue sea and the white sand. There was enough wind and tide to enable us to sail a net to the northwest side of the island, where we anchored off the bathing beach. Most of the inhabitants of Nordenay swam out to the yacht at one time or another, and all the morning our decks were wet with numbers of cheerful bathers. Once we counted 43 people on board at a time, and it was a miracle that the deck stood the weight, some of our visitors being by no means light. For a day or two we had a very cheery time and met almost everybody. We made a number of acquaintances, including a very pleasant Swedish army captain and his wife and some of his friends, all of whom spoke English. As a whole, people were friendly and hospitable, but even without any knowledge of German, it was clear that trouble was in the air. Inflation was rampant, and indeed, the mark was on the verge of collapse. This brought ruin to many of the older families and to those on fixed incomes, including, of course, service pensioners. There was a sense of unsettlement and an undercurrent of politics. Among the educated Germans, there appeared to be regret that England and Germany had been at war, but the principal bitterness was the use by the French of coloured troops on the Rhine. I was foolish enough to mention war atrocities and the treatment of prisoners in German camps. But no, here it is, X, commandant of X camp. He will tell you all about it. And then the commandant appeared, a pleasant kind of officer, and it is a bit difficult to allege ill treatment in a prison camp unless one has been there, so I changed the subject. Another topic of conversation was the Jews. Anti-Semitism was manifest, and I was told that Nordenay was being invaded by Jews who had profiteered since the war. At the neighbouring island of Joist, they said no Jews were permitted to land. Some of the Germans were so ingratiating that they obviously wanted something out of us, And then there was a certain set that was completely hostile. At one particular cafe, frequently mainly by ex-officers, we felt our presence was most unwelcome. Dunsterville could speak some German, though Buster and I preferred German interpreters, many of whom could speak English fluently. If any of us had been good linguists, we might have fathomed the undercurrents, as it turned out we were to learn them in a different way. On Sunday, July the 8th, we were spending the evening at a cabaret show. The weather did not look quite so settled as it had in the last few days previously, and at 11:30 p.m. I put my head outside and noticed the wind was freshening from the north. We strolled round to the front to see what the sea looked like, but as it was quite quiet, we returned to the cabaret. At midnight, Dunsterville went back to the ship, and shortly afterwards we followed him, as the breeze was freshening again and the night very dark. I decided that Annette must be sailed round the other side under the lee of the island, so Buster and I made our way out to the front. We found the dinghy gone, so assuming Dunsterville was on board, we hailed but got no reply, nor could we see the yacht in the dark. I, to put it mildly, was not pleased, as I thought either Dunsterville or the harbour master had, without consulting me, taken her round to the harbour, as the weather looked like breaking up. We followed the shore for 2 miles round to the harbour. No Annette. We walked back. No Annette. What the devil could have happened to her? At about 2:30 a.m, we thought we saw her brown sails about a mile out to sea, but we were not sure, as it was not light enough to see clearly. We could make out that the sailing was erratic, so I felt sure it must be Dunsterville handicapped by sailing her single-handed. We followed the boat round towards the harbour, when suddenly we saw she was steering south, away from the island. We turned round towards the town again, and who should we see but Dunsterville? When he had left us, he found the dinghy missing and hurried back to the cabaret. As we followed him, almost at once we had missed each other in the dark, and both parties were under the impression that the other was in charge of Annette. We then realised we were in for trouble and hurried round to the police station. There was a notice outside, indicating that it would open at 8 a.m. We knocked on the door and made a lot of noise, but it had no effect on the inhabitants. Apparently, policemen sleep well. Our attempts to get into any hotel also failed, so we were forced to rest as best we could in a seat on the deserted promenade. 3 Englishmen, sitting all night on the front, must have presented a somewhat comic sight. The prospects were most depressing. Our yacht was gone, and with her our passports, money, and all our possessions, except about £2 between us. A nice way of getting marooned in a foreign country. At about 6 a.m, we came across some fishermen and started off again to the police station. On the way, we encountered one of the very fattest men I have ever seen in my life. He wore white trousers, a size or two too small, and a bright blue jumper, and from his manner I gathered he was a person of some importance. He spoke English well, and took charge of affairs with the utmost pomposity. First, he visited the police station, where he succeeded in getting them to open 30 minutes earlier than usual, and at 7:30 a.m, telegrams were sent to Borkum, Nordyke, Delfzijl, and Heligoland. It was obvious that the yacht had been stolen, but opinion differed as to whether she had been taken by thieves or by bad characters using her as a means of escape from the island. In either event, they would probably make for Holland. Then followed a most exasperating 2 hours in which nothing was done, except a general powwow among the officials. A fast motorboat was needed for the pursuit, but here we were handicapped as we had no money. However, the porpoise, our fat friend, obligingly came to our assistance with a loan of 1,000,000 marks. Arrangements were made to charter a motorboat, but time flew while the officials talked. We were hungry and tired after walking about all the night and could only get a little bread and butter, as the police would not spare us the time to go to a hotel for breakfast. They said things were too serious and we must be ready to start at a moment's notice. Well, we waited like that for 2.5 hours, until the whole party slowly strolled down to the harbour. Here, a report was received that Annette was aground off Nordyke, a tidal harbour on the mainland opposite Nordenay, with a station and a railway line to Norden and the south. On the receipt of this news, the whole party went for a drink at a neighbouring cafe. Apparently, there was no longer any urgency to recover the yacht, and still less to contact the thieves or cut off their escape. At 11:30, all was ready. The party was prepared for the fray. Excitement was intense as we prepared to embark on the racing motorboat. Spectators spoke in whispers as our gallant crew prepared themselves for hostilities. Our striking force consisted of the chief of police, a sergeant and two young constables, all armed with big revolvers. Next in command now appeared to be the pianist of the local cabaret, who strutted about in a brightly coloured sweater. He and, of course, the porpoise made a colourful picture. Last but not least, we had the sturdy crew to back us up, mahogany-faced fishermen with their kindly faces set in grim determination to help these poor Englishmen. I wondered why we needed so many men to handle the motorboat, but when we arrived at the quayside to embark, I found out. The motorboat proved to be a very, very old fishing boat with antiquated sails and no trace whatever of a motor. It was distinctly a setback after the romances that the porpoise had spun about there being no chance of a net escaping from the craft at the disposal of the police. The porpoise's Christian name was Rudy, an adjective we never failed to apply to him after this episode. The fishing boat cast off and the police ordered us below, explaining that the pirates might recognise us. The others remained on deck, on the astonishing assumption that the thieves would see nothing odd in their appearance. One of the crew stood on the bowsprit, staring at the horizon through binoculars. Rudy strutted up and down the deck, apparently believing he would be mistaken for a bluebird, while the pianist squatted down in the middle of the deck with a rope coiled round him to look like a capstan. Meanwhile, the chief of police, pink with excitement, fired his revolver in the air to tell the world we were out duck shooting. Altogether, we made a fine assault party, the only pity being that Gilbert and Sullivan were not present to witness it. The police at Nordyke were on the lookout, so it was very probable that the thieves would remain aboard Annette until nightfall. We had about 6 miles to sail before coming to close quarters, but within a quarter of a mile of the harbour, the fishing boat ran hard aground. Rudy explained it would have been all right if we had started half an hour earlier. The big dinghy was pulled alongside and into it jumped the police, Rudy and the pianist. Before we realised what was happening, they cast off and rowed away in the direction of Nordyke, leaving us and a couple of fishermen on the fishing boat. The rest of the morning we spent drying out on the sands. There was neither water nor food on board, and the sun blazed down mercilessly on the hard, hot deck, where we tried to sleep. At 2:30 p.m, the tide had risen sufficiently to allow the fishing boat to sail back into the harbour. Her total share in operations had been a quarter of a mile sail out of the harbour and a quarter of a mile back in. We spent the afternoon making various arrangements and fixing up a hotel. We had, of course, only the clothes we stood up in, plus £2 and Rudy's million marks. Late in the evening, we received news that Annette had been recovered and we walked down to the harbour. There we found a crowd had gathered. The harbour master chatted condescendingly to some admirers. The search party had returned and a space was kept clear for the chief of police and his sergeant, who wore a uniform comprised of a green tailcoat with brass buttons and white flannel trousers. He fingered his tin-plated sword and thoughtfully stroked his white beard. The constables were likewise attired, but wore pantaloons instead of tennis trousers. After waiting a while, we saw Annette, and presently she came alongside the wharf with a resounding crash. I elbowed my way through the crowd and went aboard. The yacht's cabin was crowded with people. Everybody was talking at once, and high above the din, I heard Rudy's voice raised in loud lament. He had been the first to board Annette and had soiled his bright blue jumper. I gathered that the yacht had been found deserted and that the thieves had already made their escape over the sands at low water. The ship herself had been turned inside out. Blankets, bread, papers, cups, clothes lay in confusion on the floorboards, all soaked through. The salvage party had drunk everything on board and eaten most of the provisions. I did not grudge them that, but I did object to the filthy mess they had made. However, the ship was safe, and wonder of wonders, my cash had not been found, although in the most obvious place of the lot. Of course, the one topic of conversation was salvage. Were they to get £1,000 or £1? I guessed it would be nearer the latter. However, it was agreed we should meet next day and discuss it at the police station. In spite of that, Rudy waddled home with us and with dignity refused a present of £5 for his services, as he claimed relationship to a British ex-cabinet minister. I had to walk to the other side of the island, have a meal and get back to the ship in an hour, according to the harbour master's instructions. As I could not waste time, I left Rudy with Dunsterville, to whom he confided he had never been so insulted. Next day, we all met at the office of the Chief of Police, and he fixed salvage at £16, to be paid to the skipper of the fishing boat. Rudy then climbed down and argued and bargained like a human being. During the interview, it came out that I thought he was a person of authority, and the police thought he was my friend and representative. It appeared he had taken a place in the dinghy, which should have been mine. In the end, he got £2 instead of the £5 I would willingly have given him the night before, when I thought his help had been from disinterested motives. The last I heard was that the fisherman was claiming back £2 from Rudy for trespassing on his ship. £16 in Germany was then equivalent in purchasing power to £50 in England. A fisherman earned between 5 and 10 shillings a week. The thieves, two of them, left in their haste a lot of propaganda papers of the militarist party, a hat, a German flag, an eagle, a dagger, and a book of addresses. They stole some clothes and, above all, 2 cameras, the loss of which we felt particularly, as we never got the same percentage of good photos with the remaining one. It appeared that when Annette ran aground, the thieves waited until low water and then waded over the flats to the shore in full view of the land. One of them was wearing an English suit, Dunsterville's, the one he went overboard in, and carrying on his back a large kit bag full of booty. Apparently, they strolled like that through the little town of Nordyke, where the police were supposed to be on the lookout for them, and waited at the station for the next train. The papers identified them as being members of the Ludendorff Party, which was nearly as strong in Germany as the government. It certainly looked as though the motive was escape from the island rather than theft, and maybe if the police had caught and arrested them, there would have been reprisals. Certainly, the police had made no great effort to stop them, and we wondered who were the culprits, whether they were from the ex-officer's cafe or two of the bathers who had shown a most inquisitive interest in the yacht. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly, and remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.